Hello, and welcome to the Preview Spotlight Interviews on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer.
And I'm Bob Bretall. In this episode, we'll be talking with creators about upcoming projects available in the current month's previews catalog. We've got some great interviews this month. We're going to first talk to Rasan Ekadal, who is doing art on the new Solomon Kane miniseries from Dark Horse Comics, written by Bruce Jones. We're going to be talking to Nate Simpson, who is the writer, artist, and creator of the new Non-Player miniseries out from Image. That's a creator-owned book. We have Brian Hill, who is co-writer on the Netherworld miniseries from Top Cow. And then we're going to wrap it up talking to Dwayne Harris, who is the writer, artist, and creator on another creator-owned book, Black Powder, out from Asylum Press. Hopefully everyone will enjoy the interviews. I had a really good time recording them all this month. Now we're going to be talking to Rasan Ekadal, who is the artist on the new Solomon Kane series out from Dark Horse. He's also currently working on the Echoes series with Josh Fialkov from Top Cow. Thanks for joining me, Rasan.
Hey, Bob. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so Solomon Kane, Red Shadows, number one, that's here in the current previews catalog. You're working with Bruce Jones on that as the writer. Tell me a little bit about how you got attached to the project and a little something about, as you can about kind of a high level on the story and how you're enjoying working on it.
Yeah, well, Dark Horse... Yeah, they were looking to relaunch the Solomon Kane title. I think they did two miniseries, and they wanted to start a third. And they were looking to kind of go in a new direction with the creative team. So Philip Simone, the editor, had actually been trying to work something out with me for a while, and I unfortunately had to turn down a project on Conan about a year ago, because my schedule was too full. It was just going to be a single issue, but it was like one of the worst decisions I had to make, because I'd always wanted to work on Conan. But anyway, so we just kept in contact, and then when Solomon Kane came up, he just gave me a call, and we set it up. So we're adapting Red Shadows, which is what I think it might have been the first Solomon Kane story that Robert Howard wrote. And if I'm wrong on that, you know, the Howard fans take my hat off, but I believe it was one of the first published stories. At least chronologically, it's early in Kane's career. And so we're adapting that, and then we're also adapting Skulls and the Stars, which is the very first issue of our miniseries, is Skulls and the Stars, and then it kind of segues into Red Shadows.
Very cool. Now, you said that you were, for a long time wanting to do a Conan story. Now, Conan, most famous of Robert E. Howard's creations, and it's always a good thing to, like, have too much work, I suppose. But had you been familiar with Solomon Kane before, his kind of Puritan adventurer?
Yeah. I think he's a really cool character. I mean, I like all of Robert E. Howard's characters. Rand McMoran is another one that I've always enjoyed reading, and yeah, Solomon Kane is cool because he's kind of nuts, really. He's probably the most intense and sort of obsessive character that Howard created, and I like his sort of weird psychological makeup,
So how did you approach, so you got contacted about being on the, being the artist on this series, so that's great. So okay, yeah. You're there. Bruce Jones, I'm sure, got contacted, and
Well, that's what happened with it. Originally, Scott Alley was going to write it. He had written the first few series, but he got too busy with everything that he does up at Dark Horse. He runs the ship in a lot of ways. So he decided to step back, and then Philip was able to get Bruce Jones on board, which was great. And they were able to line that up quickly and announce it at San Diego last summer. So yeah, it's really cool, and it's been great working with him.
Cool. So tell me a little bit about working on this project. So you get a script from Bruce. Do you talk to Bruce at all about it, or you just pretty much get a script and then set to it?
Yeah, mostly Philip, the editor, talks to me. So I don't work directly with Bruce very much, but I get the script and then, start sending in art and getting feedback from the editor, and he gives me notes and we go from there. So yeah, I'm not like on the phone every day with Bruce, but it's definitely fun to work off his scripts. He's such a legend in the industry. So
there's certainly an established kind of style for Solomon Kane. He's kind of fun, I guess. He's got that big cloak he wears, he's got that hat, he's got
a pistol
in one hand and a sword in the other one, and he's, kicking butt and taking names, out there, so tell me a little bit about, because the visual look is kind of established for him, but how did you work with that?
Well, the funny thing that cracked me up as soon as I got offered the Solomon Kane gig was that, back when I first started working in the industry, I was working at Boom Studios, and they were doing Games Workshop licensed comics, the Warhammer tabletop games.
Uh-huh.
And so I did a whole miniseries on a character that exists in the Warhammer universe that is basically a knockoff of Solomon Kane. So when I landed, I was like, this is kind of coming full circle here. So I drew the Solomon Kane knockoff, and now I'll be on the real guy at last. So, but as far as approaching him visually, yeah, he's got a real specific look. Obviously, he's got that dark, brooding Puritan kind of costume and everything, and you can't stray too far from that. But for me, I wanted to bring a little bit of, character to his facial expressions and body postures, and try to give him kind of a unique body language, a unique face, and try to portray a lot of his character through that. So, of course, he's always going to be wearing black and have the tall hat and everything, but there's a lot you can do with kind of who he is, with how he moves and how he expresses himself. So that's the angle that I came at it from. There was a movie, a Solomon Kane movie that was released in Europe. I think it was made in France.
I'm not familiar with the Solomon Kane movie, so you're telling me something new here.
it's like barely known in the US. I'm not sure exactly where it was produced, but it stars James Purefoy, who was
Mark
Antony on HBO's Rome series.
Yeah, I love that series. Yeah,
yeah,
I know who you're talking about.
He's a great actor.
Yeah.
So they came up with a pretty cool look for him in that movie, but I actually purposely did not watch it before starting to draw Kane because I didn't want to be overly influenced. But I did look at the imagery a little bit to kind of see what was also out there.
Mm-hmm.
My approach is just a real dark, kind of brooding, sort of Batman-like Solomon Kane, where, his cloak is a big visual character, and he's pretty tough, and he's pretty aggressive in his body language, and pretty fast in his fighting style and stuff, so, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Solomon Kane is, for people who are not familiar with the character, I mean, he's a lot, he's a lot less... how do I want to say it? Like Conan, for instance, there's a lot of gray area to Conan, He's relatively honorable, but I mean, he'll flex things one way or another. You know, there's a lot of gray area in how Conan's going to hit any given situation. You know, whereas Solomon Kane's pretty black and white. I mean, there's right and there's wrong, and he's just a very, you know, staid, you know, this is the way that I'm going to go, and he's, you know, very inflexible in that respect. So,
he's inflexible to the point of obsession, and that's kind of like the theme of Red Shadows is that he pursues this guy, the villain of the story, across continents and across years for a single crime that the guy committed because he's so obsessed with justice being done. But then there's all this like sort of subtext in the original Howard story, like all these like interesting hints about Solomon Kane's motivations, and that like he is obsessed with justice and right and wrong and sort of his Puritan moral values, but at the same time there's this other sort of unnameable like obsession inside of him that he doesn't even quite understand, and that like drives him to pursue these quests and adventures, and he's almost like at the whim of his own psychology, or at the mercy of his own psychology, I should say. So I think that's really interesting. He's kind of he's definitely a complex character, even though he is sort of black and white in his actions. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that's exactly correct. But it's kind of an interesting because there's not that many characters like that. So you know it's. If you read too much of that, it gets kind of wearing, but, you know, it's kind of an interesting, you know, change of pace because he is very different from a lot of other characters that you're going to see
out there.
He is a very interesting, I like the character from that respect, and, you know, he's kind of fun just to see, you know, some of the situations. They always seem to, you know, you have Solomon Kane going up against some weird, you know, supernatural thing or put into some kind of a situation where, you know, well, it's not a question. You know, it's just he's going to go right at it because he's not going to stop until justice or the right has been served.
And in Red Shadows, he's the main villain is actually a man. There's nothing supernatural about him. He's just like this French bandit who happens to cross paths with Kane, and Kane becomes obsessed with finding him and killing him. That's really interesting too, because there's no like evil monster. It's like another man, you know.
Is there anything like that? Because I'm looking at the first issue covers, and there's some weird monster on the cover of the first issue.
Yeah, Skulls in the Stars. There's like this. It takes place out on the moors of England, and there's a sort of like ghostly apparition that attacks him while he's trying to cross the moors. Yeah.
You always got to watch out for those misty moors out in England.
Exactly. Yeah. So then he has to go and like try to unravel what this thing is and why it's out there. Yeah.
Okay, so on this book, you're doing pencils, and then they're going straight from the pencils to the finished work, and Dan Jackson's doing the coloring on that. So that process tends to give you a little softer, more painted look because you don't have the hard ink lines, you know, to to dealing with. So why don't you talk a little bit about how your interaction with Dan has worked on that?
Well, Dan's great. He's really talented. He's done a lot of Star Wars work at Dark Horse and some other stuff. I don't think he gets a chance to flex his, like, painter muscles very often, so he was, like, he was pretty excited to start working on this book. When he got my first pencils in, he was pretty jazzed, and this, you know, all the pages I've got back from him have been amazing. So he's going full painted, you know. It looks really beautiful and really textural. So I definitely think it's some of the best work that he's ever done, and I'm just honored to be able to work with him. Yeah. And working in pencil is is fun for me because I haven't been able to do that for a while. The last few projects I've done have all been ink, so I'm getting to kind of stretch my legs too and work in a different style. I did.
Well, what's the difference? So, you know, like when I look at Echoes, for instance, I mean, Echoes, it's black and white, right? But you're doing a lot of really nice, you know, ink washing or shadowing, or you can talk a little bit about your process on that, but it's not just like black and white line art. You add a lot of depth and texture to that, even though it's being printed in black and white. So I would imagine that the amount of time it's taking you to put together a page of that series is going to be different than, you know, doing pencils only on something like Solomon Kane. So maybe you can kind of talk about your process on Echoes and maybe do a compare and contrast.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, with a book like Echoes or the work I did on Creepy, it's all ink wash and yeah, I'm finishing the artwork. So what I do is what's going to be seen on the printed page. So I put a lot of layering, a lot of texturing, a lot of washing, just to build up sort of a nice three-dimensional world, you know. But then, obviously, working with colorists, then I'm able to anticipate what he's going to do and leave a little bit more unfinished in a sense. Sorry, my cats are going crazy next to me. where am I at? I lost my place.
Before the cats attacked, we were talking about the layering that you were putting into the Echoes project.
Well, yeah, just it's a lot more work doing a black and white book for me because I feel like I need to present a really finished, like polished piece of art for each page, you know, because that's what everybody's going to see.
Whatever you finish is what they're going to print, right? Nobody else is going to come in and do anything else to it.
Exactly, yeah. Which is really fun because it gives me a ton of control over what the reader is experiencing. And when you work with a colorist, you know, I send my pencils off and then while I have feedback and we work together and we talk and everything, like ultimately it is someone else finishing the artwork and that's what people are going to see. So yeah, definitely a very different process.
Cool.
Yeah, but Dan's been great. We work together really well and get along well, and yeah, I can't wait for everybody to see the finished artwork on this because it's really fun and colorful and like bold and you know, full of action and everything. So,
no, I mean that's great. You know, I encourage everyone if they've never checked out a Solomon Kane story before, to you know, definitely have a look at this series. It should have a special discount from DCBS if you're a DCBS customer. So that'll make that kind of a, you know, no-brainer kind of choice, you know, try it out for not that much. Especially since the first issue of this is kind of a standalone story, and then the last three issues are really that adaptation of the other story. But it'll kind of give you a feeling for the character if you've never tried it before. And I'm really looking forward to seeing your work, you know, with the painted colors on top of it, too. So,
thanks, yeah. Thanks, I'm looking forward to it.
I will say that, you know, I for the first time, you know, you've moved into the category. I was like flipping through Creepy number 2 and I got to a story and I said, that looks like Rassan's work. And then I flipped back to the first page and oh, indeed it was, you know, or I didn't know going in, you know, cause it was an anthology book. So I can spot your style now.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah. I hope I can do more Creepy too. That'll be good to come back to that. I've done 2 stories over there so far.
Yeah, that doesn't come out. That doesn't come out quite so frequently, but it's still a fun book, you know.
Yeah,
not too many horror anthologies out there.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah.
No, very good. So, look in your catalog. It's under Dark Horse, and looking forward to seeing that. Echoes is on the stands. Issues number 1 and number 2 are out as you listen to this. Number 3 will be coming out at the end of February. Very kind of, let's just say, kind of creepy, horror-y kind of story, but not more like that psychological horror, not like monster horror. You know?
No, it's not gross-out horror. It's very psychological and, kind of about mental illness.
But, it's a really good story. And your art, I think, you're doing a really good job of capturing, the tone and the mood on that one, too. And I kind of like the black and white with it, especially the way that you're doing the, the more richer kind of artwork on it as opposed to the, just stark line work that you see a lot of times.
Yeah, that was really gratifying experience to draw Echoes. I'm all finished with it. I'm just working on Solomon Kane now because we did everything for Echoes in advance of the release so that it would come out on time.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, working on that was pretty amazing because I was just so focused and inside of that process for 8 months or whatever. Yeah, but yeah, the first issue actually sold out back in December. And we went to a second printing, which came out with issue 2 a couple weeks ago. And, issue 3 is February 23rd, I think, was the date that I saw. Yeah. So I guess that's the last Wednesday of February.
Very cool.
Yeah. And then Solomon Kane is April.
Yep.
April 6th, I believe, yeah.
So if you want to get your fix of Solomon Kane, I will, as always, direct people to their comic shops and just say, hey, let your comic shop owner know that you're interested in the book. It's one of these titles that is not necessarily going to be big piles of them sitting on the rack if you do not ask your comic shop to stock it specifically. So, if you
that
like...
That's what happened with... That's what happened with Echoes, too, You got to ask your shop owner these days if you want something that's not, big and mainstream.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Yeah.
And it's a good palate cleanser, It's something different. You're going to be checking out something that's definitely going to be a breath of fresh air from, the normal comic reading experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for joining me. And,
thanks,
I look forward to this book.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks a lot.
Now I'm joined by Nate Simpson, who is the writer, artist, and creator of a new comic called Non-Player that you're going to see in the Image section of your catalog, be out in April. Thanks for joining me, Nate.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Non-Player... from the sample art, and you'll be able to see the sample art at www.nonplayercomic.com. I'll also have that link in the show notes, but the sample art's beautiful. You've got 8 pages up on your site.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about the kind of high-level overview of what the series is about?
Sure. Well, Non-Player takes place in a future where massively multiplayer games have gotten so realistic and so immersive that they're in many ways superior to reality. And that evolution hasn't just been about graphics, but the AI of the Non-Player characters has evolved as well. So there's this point where their behavior becomes indistinguishable from real humans, and the characters start to realize that they're being hunted for sport. So that's the setting, and the protagonist is this girl named Dana, who in the real world, she really doesn't have that much going for her. She's 3 years out of high school. She's still living with her mom. She works at a tamale stand. She really has no prospects at all. But she's also this elite assassin in an MMO called Warriors of Jarvath. And sort of by chance, she happens to kill a game character's wife, and she does it right around the time when the game characters are becoming sentient. So she kind of unwittingly ends up being the target of this game character's vendetta. And then all sorts of crazy stuff happens.
That's just a really cool idea. So we're going to be seeing in the game, and we'll be seeing outside the game also?
That's right. In the first issue, the first half of the first issue takes place in a fantasy world, and then the second half of the issue takes place in a sort of, I won't say dystopian, but a fairly run-down Los Angeles of the mid-21st century.
Now, is there any bleed over of the non-player characters into the real world in any way, or is it more once she's in the game, she's going to have that interaction, and she has kind of a different storyline outside the game?
Well, she definitely, very much interaction happens inside the game. If I told you whether that interaction extended outside the game, I'd have to get into spoiler territory. So
okay,
I'll
well, don't do
that.
Don't do that. We don't want to get spoilers on it, because I want to enjoy the comic as I read it.
There's a lot of bleed over in both directions, from the game to the real world, and from the real world into the game.
Okay, let's talk about some of the design work that you've done. The preview pages are all set in the fantasy world, so as I look at the pages you have here, you've got, you know, very lush terrain. You've got these warriors that are riding giant beasts. You have a giant furry beast with a couple of horns, and there's a big palanquin on its back, and people are riding in it. You have, I'm assuming, is the redhead, is that Dana?
That's Dana, yeah.
Yeah, and she's got this big, like, battle cat or something with her. Just really cool designs on everything. What was your inspiration and, you know, background that led you to doing all this design work for the game?
Well, for the fantasy stuff, definitely Mobius is one of my big influences. I really loved Arzak and the Airtight Garage. And you may, a lot of people have seen the Mobius in the way that I draw. Also, William Stout, actually, he wrote a book called The New Dinosaurs in the 1970s that I found at the library when I was a kid, and the way that guy draws dinosaurs is just amazing, and a lot of the way I draw creatures, I think, is really heavily influenced by William Stout. And maybe a little bit of Arthur Rackham, especially in the way... I really love the way he draws trees and landscapes, and I've looked at his stuff for many, many years, so it's probably kind of infected the way that I draw.
Yeah, I can, now that you mention it, I can see a little of the Mobius and the Stout in there. William Stout has a lot of great dinosaur things out. He's at the San Diego Comic-Con every year, you know, and he's got his prints and sketchbooks and things like that, so I've gotten some of those over the years, so I know exactly what you're talking about.
And he's such a nice guy, too. I actually sent him a sample of Non-Player just and said thank you for, you know, sort of inspiring me to draw creatures, and he was a complete gentleman. He was a really, really nice guy. Yeah, I look forward to meeting him at San Diego this year.
Now, what was your inspiration for the future Los Angeles?
Well, that's actually, for me, was a little trickier, because I didn't want to make a dystopia. There are so many sort of binary, sort of dystopian movies that, like, you know, Blade Runner is probably the best example, or even sort of the real world in The Matrix. I didn't want it to be just a completely burnt out post-apocalyptic crap heap. I wanted to feel sort of like an extrapolation of the way things are going now, which is, you know, everyone is still making do. The economy is a little bit worse. The environment's a little bit worse. Because people have access to augmented reality technologies, the built environment is far more utilitarian and far less well kept up, because people, you know, can sort of overlay whatever reality they want over their surroundings. So a lot of graffiti, a lot of wires, a lot of conduits, definitely Jeff Darrow's Hard Boiled was a big sort of influence on the way I draw cityscapes. So again, that sort of clear line Mobius Jeff Darrow kind of way of looking at cities.
Very cool. Now let's talk a little bit about the process. Now, when you've put the story together, this is a 6-issue series?
That's correct.
Now, talk a little bit about, did you put together an outline of the entire 6 issues and kind of break it down? And, what was your process for doing the story? And then maybe segue from that into how you went from the story to the visual breakdowns.
I kind of secretly want Non-Player to be a movie someday. So I set up the story with a fairly conventional 3-act structure, and I broke it down in a step outline, just scene by scene. So the entire 6 issues is already sort of set up in terms of the major plot points and the order that they occur. And then for me, just the big challenge has been learning how to write credible dialogue and real characters. What was the second half of your question?
Well, then when you take that that plot structure and you kind of overlay that onto the issues and do the visual breakdowns, how does that work?
Very iteratively. Usually I draw just some very, very rough layouts, sort of thumbnail sketches in a sketchbook. That's the last time pencil touches paper. And then from there, I go into the computer and everything, all the final pages are drawn in Photoshop using a Wacom Cintiq tablet monitor. So unfortunately, there's no actual physical artwork at the end of the process since everything happens inside the computer. So no extra money for me selling original artwork, unfortunately. But I do like working with the computer.
So you have a crazy amount of detail on these pages. That's just they're gorgeous, but it's got to take a long time to do this. What kind of time do you spend putting one of these pages together?
It is a slow process. Some of the pages take up to a week to complete. It really depends on how many panels there are. Strangely, if there's one big splash image covering the entire page, that's the fastest page for me. But the more panels there are, even though I'm covering the same area of page with artwork, just having to, emotionally deal with so many different perspectives sort of slows me down. But yeah, usually about a week. I've had to sort of remind myself that I'm taking the quality, not quantity, road here, and that better to draw one nice comic and be remembered for that than draw 12 okay comics. And so that's the speed, and that's the speed.
Yeah, well, the craft in what you're doing is, at least from my perspective, is showing through on the page. I mean, there's a lot of detail, and it's really nice looking. So I'm really seriously looking forward to seeing this book coming out when it does. I want to urge everyone who's listening, again, go out to www.nonplayercomic.com. Check out these preview pages. And if you like what you see, go to your comic shop now. Because now, right now in February, is when your comic shop is putting their order together. That's when they're going to be putting in the order for Non-Player and all the other books in the February previews that we're talking about. Tell them, I want this comic. Make sure that they order copies so that they're on the stands. And if you think it looks cool, tell some other people about it too. Because, these are the kind of things, we really want to support when someone puts together some really good quality comics for our enjoyment. So do what you can and get out there and talk to your comic shop owner too, because I'd really love to see this available for people to pick up off the rack and discover.
Wow, thanks, Bob. I really appreciate that.
So with that, I want to thank you for the time that you spent with me, Nate. And again, really looking forward to seeing this when it comes out in April. This is going to be a fun ride, so I'll be there for all six issues. Thanks a lot for taking the time.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, and I've got now Brian Hill, who is the co-writer of the Netherworld project coming out from Top Cow in April. You might have seen some marketing from Top Cow and some billboards in various places that said, "We are all lost." Well, that "We are all lost" is was a tie-in to Netherworld, and we'll talk a little bit about that as well. Thank you for joining me, Brian.
Thank you for having me, Bob.
So let's start with the marketing campaign, "We Are All Lost." How does that kind of tie into things?
Well, I've got a background in advertising and marketing. Before I started writing, I worked freelance for a few ad agencies after I graduated NYU. And so the Netherworld concept was actually created by Heroes and Villains, and they approached Rob and myself about writing the script. So we talked about it, and it's a story about a dystopic society. It's a story about feeling disconnected, about the general sort of malaise that sets in when you're not feeling like you're part of a larger human community, like the isolation that happens in cities, if you will. That's thematically what we're dealing with. So I came up with the idea of just saying we are all lost as a series of graphic statements and putting those out there and seeing how people reacted to those things and try to evoke a feeling inside an audience. And they might not even know what it's about or what it means, but we've gotten a lot of interesting feedback from people who obviously haven't read the book because the book hasn't come out yet. But they started responding to that in a philosophical way and dancing around the idea on their own. And I think it's doing a lot to sort of set the stage for the narrative.
Cool. I certainly noticed that. I made the connection when I was reading the solicit, and in there it said, it had "We Are All Lost" quoted, and I said, ah, so this is the book. I didn't know what I was expecting. But I just want to make sure that people know, if you saw that marketing campaign and you're interested and say, oh, what's that all about? Well, what it's all about is Netherworld number one.
It is indeed about Netherworld number one. I mean, I really tried to evoke that. One time I was in New York City and I was driving around in a taxi cab. And I actually saw one of those people you always see in like Frank Miller comic books who had a sign on his chest that said that the end is near, right? And it was pretty haunting. Just kind of seeing a guy who had this sign on it, this apocalyptic thing, and seeing the juxtaposition of that guy with the city and people not really paying attention to him, but it really stuck in my mind because, someone can say the most insane thing in the world to you, but you always wonder, a little bit, like, they might be right. Like, maybe they're the one person that understands what's really going on in the world, and everyone else who thinks that their jobs or their social lives or their realities are more important, they don't really get it. But this one guy, is the guy who understands. So that's really what I wanted to bring to the table with HVE, Heroes and Villains. And those guys were really great to work with because they're super progressive when it comes to thinking about, how to launch a property and build a property and do that kind of work. And I'm an out there dude. My mind is out there, right? So I give them a lot of credit for keeping up with the ideas that we've been throwing at them and being really open to discussing things and finding new ways to expose comic book storytelling to the current readership and hopefully build a readership outside of the current so that more people are brought to the table.
Very good. Now, Heroes and Villain Entertainment, tell me a little bit about them. I mean, you said that they hired you and Rob to write this. How much of the idea did they come to you with, and how much did the two of you flesh out in it? And maybe also in and amongst that, you can talk about your partnership and relationship in creating this along with Rob.
Sure. Well, I know the Heroes and Villains guys socially, and And that's really how a lot of my comic work comes about. I'm also a screenwriter, and I'm a novelist. I'm getting a book deal together, actually, this month. So I really kind of cherry-pick the stuff that I work on in comics. And so I knew those guys kind of hanging out at Comic-Con for a few months before we even talked about working together. And then they cut space with Rob and myself and said, look, we got this idea. And we've got a lot of, you know, a lot of stuff kind of floating around it. We haven't really super organized, like, act structure, all that. We know we want a character that's like this. We want, you know, a female lead that's like that, and want the world to be like this. So Rob and I got on the phone with them, and we just kind of let them talk to us. You know, and said, well, open up the floodgates, you know, douse us in whatever you guys have worked out on your end, and then let us put that in the incubator, as it were. And then we'll kind of come back to you with some ideas. So they, you know, they hopped on the phone. We talked for about an hour or so. Actually, they talked, and Rob and I listened and took notes. And then, you know, Rob and I kind of talked about the story as we heard it. And we traded some of the stuff that we're into and thought about bringing some of our own archetypal ideas to it and some characterization. And then we kind of came up with a three-act way to help heroes and villains, you know, build that narrative world, and brought it back to them, and it, like, didn't. So we just kind of started working together that way. I mean, and as for the you know, the collaboration with them, they have final call on everything. It really is like Rob and I being brought on to, you know, write a television series that you didn't really conceive, but you're doing some of the episodes. Like when Morgan and Wong were working on The X-Files, right? The X-Files is obviously Chris Carter's baby. It's Chris Carter's thing, but, you know, when Morgan and Wong were brought on, they were allowed to sort of do their own thing inside the Mulder and Scully universe, and that's really what Rob and I are doing here with Netherworld. You know, Heroes and Villains did certainly conceive the IP and the main characters, and they released them to us to work with, but they really do make all the final decisions.
Now, here brings up the question in my mind anyway. So is Heroes and Villains Entertainment, what exact kind of company are they? Is this like a video game tie-in? Is it a movie tie-in? Is it a property that stands on its own? Like, what kind of company is that, you know, for intellectual property development and all in that?
Correct. I can't tell you all the vagaries of their corporate structure because, frankly, Bob, I don't know them. But I do know this. I know that they manage writers. They don't manage Rob and myself, but they do have a stable of writers that they work with. They develop intellectual properties and then figure out what medium they want to you know, leverage them into first, I suppose. So they have things they're working on that they want to start as films. They have things they're working on that they want to start as comics. They have things they're working on they want to start as games, I would imagine, as well. I told them that if we were going to write the comic, then we were only going to deal with them as a publisher. We were only going to deal with them in terms of the literary merit of the thing. I'm personally very opposed to the idea of people using comics simply as a way to launch films. I think that a lot of the boldness in comic book storytelling has been wounded because people often censor it so that Hollywood can understand. And when I was growing up, reading a comic book was the most adrenalized way you could get a genre story. You know, I grew up on Grant Morrison and Arkham Asylum, you know, and Frank Miller's work, some of the early Vertigo stuff, and a lot of the X-Men stuff, you know, the Renegade stuff. And those are the experiences I loved in comic books. So I told them, like, look, if the goal here is simply to make a movie, if we're just putting out, you know, six issues of a comic book, and we're asking people to pay for it, but this is really just pre-visualization so we can walk into the studio and say, hey, here's the film, I don't want to be involved in that, because I don't think that's fair to the reader. I don't think it's fair to the medium. You know, I think there are too many companies right now that use comic books, you know, to seed their ideas, to get movies made. And what ends up happening is that consumers end up having to pay for development, basically. It's like you're paying for an art book. You're paying for a pitch book. you know, it's not really something that's going to give you a story, but they're going to put a price point on it, and they're going to put it on the shelf, and they're going to try to get people to spend their hard-earned money on it. So they're receptive to that, you know, to that perspective, and they've been great. So with us, they have been, you know, editorial. We have been dealing with them as a publisher, and they've been seriously invested into the work. So even though they are a company that has varied interests across media, and they're a pan-media company, I'm going to use some new terminology, even though that's true, with us, we're really just focused on the comic and making sure that the comic is a good read and stands on its own as a piece of, like, narrative, you know, pop art, as it were, and not just an element in a larger campaign to try to get a movie off of the ground.
Very good. That's a good answer, and glad to hear it. Glad to hear that we got something that's a comic for being a comic.
Right. Well, it's kind of like it's an epidemic now, you know, where you're seeing books come out and companies aren't really supporting the books, I think, the way they should be, because they just put them out for 4 or 5 issues and hopefully something gets attached to something. And it's unfortunate, because when literary and Hollywood come together and start feeding off of each other, then everything gets boring, because no one wants to take any risks. So the films aren't taking any risks, and the comics aren't taking any risks. So then you're going to get a lot of kind of maudlin, average fare. It's my hope that now that we have firmly established superhero as a genre, and people are able to reach into more of, like, the deeper recesses of the graphic novel libraries to find material, more of the challenging material is going to get made, so it's not just going to feel like everything has to be a PG-13 corporate romp, essentially.
Yeah, I agree. But, you know, I have mixed feelings on it, because, I mean, in some cases, there are properties that get developed that someone wants to make a movie out of, but that doesn't mean that they try to tell a good comic story, too. And, you know, given how much comics sell, I don't begrudge someone wanting to make a movie, because you can make some actual money out of a movie,
right?
You know? And as long as you kind of keep the vision and you try to tell a darn good comic book story, and then someone subsequently makes a movie out of it, well, that's fine. They're two completely different things. But if, as you say, they take the comic book and they compromise it in some way to make it, dumbed down for some Hollywood exec, although those guys seem to change things just for the heck of it anyway, so they can say that they had a thumbprint on something. I don't know, sometimes.
There's a lot of thumbprinting going on, yeah. And I don't bemoan them for that, because that's, like, the nature of, you know, that's the job. But I think the real threat here is an economic one, Bob. It's if the movies aren't engaging, they're not going to make a lot of money. And the problem is, when comic book movies fail, right? Like, we've got a lot of them coming out this year. We've got Thor, we've got Green Lantern, we've got Captain America. We've got a lot of material that's going to hit multiplexes pretty soon. And if one of those movies fails, X-Men for Class, it's going to turn into the, comic book movies don't work, because Captain America didn't do what it was supposed to do that weekend.
To some extent, I think that's really obvious when you have, like, a superhero movie. But, like, a movie like Red that came out, I mean, that was a comic book movie. But I don't think most people, other than the fact that you had a little DC logo at the front, you know, people don't look at that and say, oh, that was a comic book movie. Hey, Men in Black was a comic book movie, you know, when it came out. You know,
that's where I think the growth is, and that's the interesting thing. Like, A History of Violence is an example.
Yeah, exactly.
Something where people didn't know that it was based on a graphic novel, but it was. I think that's the stuff that, what's great is, you have big tent projects like a Green Lantern or, you know, the Avengers, which suddenly brings everyone to the table, everyone's discussing the idea of comics to film translation. The good thing is that a lot of the smaller projects now get attention, because all the attention is on comics. So, yeah, it's not certainly a bad thing, you know, per se. It's just that without paying a lot of attention to making sure that the work has an integrity, then it can lead to just another culture of mediocrity.
Right.
Hold it. And that's what, you know, you want to avoid.
Yeah, I agree. And let's go back to Netherworld now. Let's talk a little bit about the art in the book, since that's the other part that makes a comic book unique from a lot of other forms of entertainment. You know, we have the words, and we have those words married with pictures, but there's something special about a comic book, because it's not like a movie. You know, it's not
right.
It's not just, you can't just sit there and have it, like, blasted at you. You have to actually think about it. There's, you know, kind of your mental in-betweening on the panel. There's how the panels flow from one to the next to tell the story. There's, you know, panel-to-panel continuity and just clarity of storytelling in the action. Now, as you crafted this story with Rob and you're working with Tony Shaston on the art, how did that work? Did you do full script on it? Did you, you know, tell me a little bit about your interaction with Tony.
Sure. Well, first, when we were discussing which artist to approach for the book, you know, Rob and I talked about not wanting to get a histrionic artist to work on histrionic material, which means that we're doing a story that has elements of the supernatural, the supernatural action, there's elements of horror. We wanted to work with an artist that was able to bring real human emotion and characterization to the world. We wanted to make sure that the dimension in the characters was not you know, getting passed over in favor of big images of scary, scary things. So I remember Tony Shaston's work from a book he did, Occult Crimes Task Force, way back in the day, a few years ago. A friend of mine, David Atchison, wrote the book. And it's a pretty interesting thing. It was a book about the supernatural happening in a metropolitan city. It had a feel of, like, The X-Files or maybe, like, an M. Night Shyamalan thing, modern-day Twilight Zone. And I mentioned Tony's name because I've been wanting to work with him for a long time on the right piece of material. I think he's a really phenomenal talent. And he's one of those guys that's going to draw some Hugo award-winning thing, you know, at some point, and he's going to get all the accolades he deserves, so I wanted to catch him while he was so cheap. And so, you know, I brought him up, and Heroes and Villains, they were like, yeah, this is this guy is cool. I shouldn't say he's cheap, so don't anyone think you can undercut Tony Shaston by Brian Hill's words, but yeah, they responded to his art a lot, and then we decided, okay, so we're just trying to talk about the project he was in. And then once it happened, Rob and I do all the scripts first. First, I like to do as much on the page as possible. When we work with an artist, to detail things in a lot of degrees. Now, an artist can decide whether or not they want to engage everything we put in the page, right? Like, we never say, well, Tony, you have to do exactly what we said in panel 3. You have to describe, you have to draw his emotion a certain way, you have to block it a certain way. No, we preface every script with, dump what you don't want, only engage what you want to, but I feel like we should at least have perspective on it. You know, and for anyone listening to the podcast that's writing comics or thinking about writing comics or curious about how they get made, the role of the comic writer is different than in any other visual narrative medium. Because usually, and I can say this from my experience with screenwriting and playwriting, that the writer is supposed to not visually develop the story. The writer's job is to pretty much say where things happen, the dramatic action that happens, and dialogue, and then directors and art directors and costume designers and all those people come in and do all that stuff. Well, in comics, it's different. In comics, being a writer is a lot more like being a director, or like a co-director. So it's like you're directing with the artist. So Rob and I, we detail the comic books panel by panel. We talk about everything. We have detailed kind of annotations in our scripts about symbolically this is what we're trying to accomplish here. Here are the scene that was in our mind from a movie from 1943 that you might be able to use as reference if you want. Here's, you know, this actor, and we were thinking about this actor in the context of this character, all that material. Then we do all that, Tony gets the script, he reads it, he, you know, gives us questions, sends us emails, and gives us phone calls, and we kind of talk back and forth, and he says, well, what about this, what about this, what about that? It's especially difficult with Another World, because you're dealing with a new world, right? Like, it hasn't existed before. There's not 60 years of Batman or Superman to kind of point to, and you can decide how big the S is, or how big the bat is, or whether the cape is blue or black. You really have to create everything from the ground up with a new intellectual property. So, Tony brought a lot of ideas about character design and the way people look, their silhouettes, all of that stuff. And once we got on the same page with all that work, then Tony, you know, he goes off and he draws his stuff. And when we get the pencils and the inks back from him, because I think he's inking his own work, Rob and I then take another look at the finished material, and we made it just dialogue based on what's going on in the panels. You know, what you'll find is with an artist, especially an artist that's so good at human interaction, as Tony is, a lot of your dialogue becomes superfluous. A lot of it you still need because the image is doing a lot of the work. So Rob and I have been cutting. You know, we've been saying, oh, we don't need to have that second piece of the bubble here, or we don't need that bit of voice over here. So with us and Tony and every artist that Rob and I work with, it really is kind of an organic back and forth process. It's been like that on Broken Trinity, the Top Cow miniseries. It was like that in our pilot season book, 7 Days from Hell, we did with Phil Noto. And it's like that here. We like to have as much of a synergistic relationship with the artist as possible. And, you know, I'm a photographer and a filmmaker. I can't draw. That's my, like, Achilles heel. I can't even write my name in a legible way. But I try to, as much as I can, speak visual language with the artist so that, you know, we're kind of on the same page creatively. And Tony has been great. He's a really, really brilliant collaborator. And it's been a joy to kind of work with him and see what he does based on the things that Rob and I turn into.
Very good. Now, for more on Tony, and I apologize, Tony, if you listen to this, on mispronouncing your name, the actual solicit dropped one of the E's in there, and I said Shastin instead of Shastine. Now, I have enjoyed his art and other things, because I just realized, I was doing a quick search, he's the artist on 25 to Life that's currently coming out from 12 Gauge Comics that I'm enjoying quite a lot,
right.
And he's also the artist, he did a book that probably not too many people also saw, but I did because I buy way too many comics, called The Talisman, The Road of Trials, that came out from Del Rey Comics. Great job on that. Beautiful, beautiful work. So looking even now that I'm kind of making the connection, I'm looking even more forward to it because I've enjoyed his art so much on those previous projects he's done.
Oh yeah, he's brilliant. You know, he and I, we talked about a project that we're gonna, you know, hopefully try to find a home. Maybe over at Vertigo, we haven't really, you know, locked it down yet. But like a creator-owned thing that is really cool, and I think makes real use of what Tony is brilliant at. So yeah, he's definitely a guy that I want to work with in the future, sir.
Yeah, you know, so keep an eye out for this. And again, you know, Top Cow puts out some really great comics, but, you know, the caveat that I always try to mention, you get, like, sick of hearing me say this, I'm sure people who listen to the show all the time, but, you know, the reason we do these when previews is out, because probably 50% of the comic shops in the United States aren't going to pick up a single copy of a Top Cow book unless one of their customers asks them to get it for them.
Right.
So if this sounds interesting to you, absolutely now, while your shop owner is putting together his order for books that are going to be coming in April, go and say, you know, I'm really interested in seeing Netherworld from Top Cow. Can you please order a copy so I'll be able to see that? You know, don't wait until the week that it comes out and go to the store and, you know, say, oh, gee, it's not here. You know, ask now. Let's get it into the shops.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, talking to readers out there, you know, if you guys are fans of Sin City, if you're fans of H.P. Lovecraft, if you're fans of smart, supernatural, you know, action horror that is a little provocative and pushes the envelope a little bit, then I think you'll really enjoy this book. So if you're looking for an adrenalized but still kind of different experience out of a book, I think you're going to find it with this.
Very good. Well, thank you for taking the time with me today, Brian, and I am looking forward to seeing this book when it comes out in April.
Excellent, Bob. Thank you for having me.
Now we're going to talk to Dwayne Harris, who is the creator, writer, and artist of a historical fiction adventure yarn called Black Powder. It's in the February previews catalog, and it'll be coming out from Asylum Press. Thanks for joining me today, Dwayne.
Thanks for having me.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about the general idea behind Black Powder?
Well, as you mentioned, Black Powder is it's historical fiction. It takes place in 1812, and it takes place during the there was an earthquake at that time. It's called the New Madrid earthquake, and not a lot of people know about it, mostly because there weren't that many people living in the area at the time. But the fault line actually runs down the Mississippi River, and the earthquake was. There was a series of earthquakes, actually, and it registered about, the biggest one registered about 18.8 on the Richter scale. So it was the largest earthquake to ever actually hit the North American continent. So it was, it was so powerful that all these crazy things happened, like, whole towns disappeared. I think 5 whole towns disappeared. It sank islands. A lot of Indian villages disappeared, like 3 lakes. Were created by this, and one of the craziest things that happened was the Mississippi River actually ran backwards for some time. So, kind of this like crazy disaster that's sort of been forgotten, in history. But my story takes place during this, and actually largely on the river, Mississippi River, during this earthquake. And it's about a man named Robert Young, who he's sort of a Daniel Boone, Davy Crockett sort of character, and he's a former war hero. He fought in like the Indian Wars and the Barbary Coast Wars, if you've ever heard of those. And it's about his river journey on America's first steamboat, which actually happened. There actually was a maiden voyage of the first steamboat in America, which was built by a man named Roosevelt. He was Nicholas Roosevelt. He's actually the one of the ancestors of FDR and Franklin Roosevelt. But he actually built the first steamboat in America and had the misfortune of taking it down Mississippi River during this earthquake and when the river was running backwards and all that stuff. Well, in my story, Robert is on a ride on this riverboat to save the woman he loves from river pirates who have kidnapped her, and and these pirates are led by his longtime nemesis, a man who he actually served under in the Indian Wars, named Samuel Mason. So he's traveling down the river basically to save his to save his long lost love, and during this time when there's an Indian uprising, there's an earthquake. There's just all this kind of stuff, going on. So it's a little bit, it's a little bit Western. It's a little bit pirate story, with a little love triangle thrown in there too. So a lot of stuff going on, but that's in a nutshell. That's basically the story.
Cool. And have you been interested in this period of history for a long time? Is this something that has been a hobby of yours, or what? What was kind of the genesis of wanting to tell this particular story?
Well, I grew up in Missouri, actually, and I grew up listening, hearing about some of these things. And when I was in college, when I was in art school, actually, there was a bit of a scare. They thought that the fault line was going to go again. There was a guy who predicted the that earthquake. Around your area, actually. I was in San Francisco. Now I'm mixed up. Oh, it was in 1990, and it was in California. But anyway, he predicted it was going to go the New Madrigal is going to go again in 1990. It kind of caused a little bit of a, you know, panic might be too strong of a word, but it definitely was a bit of a media circus around it.
Well, getting a big earthquake like that, you know, an 8, you know, that's like the Alaska quake. And, I mean, I don't think we've had an 8 on the continental United States in the last 100 years. So, you know, that is a huge earthquake. You know, if people don't know, I mean, I live in California, so it's like earthquake, the Richter scale is a logarithmic scale. So, you know, like the big quakes that we have are usually 6 point something. That's a pretty good size quake. Yeah, so a 7 something is 10 times as big as a 6, and an 8 is 100 times as big as a 6. So, you know, this quake is 100 times the size of some of these ones that you see on the news that have happened in California. And those cause a decent amount of damage, but an 8 point something is just ridiculous. I mean, that would just wipe out. And that's when they talk about, you know, the San Andreas quake that's supposed to come, and the big one, and, you know, cause California to slide off in the ocean. That's about the magnitude they're talking about, is, you know, 8 point something. And that would do a lot of damage to a lot of a lot of places.
Yes, and it did at the time too. And you know, the difference being, of course, that there was there were only about 15,000 people living in the earthquake zone at the time. Now there's like 50 million living in that area, you know. So when you think about that, you know, I think the death toll from the New Madrid earthquake was about 1,000 dead. So 1,000 out of 15, you know, that's quite a bit.
Yeah.
If you apply that statistic today, you know, we're talking like tens of thousands of people potentially. So, and they are due for one. It goes every couple hundred years or so. So, yeah, it caused a little bit of a scare, and I remember being pretty fascinated by it. And then it just kind of, you know, put it in the back of my mind and didn't really think about it for a while. But after that, a lot of books were published on the subject, not surprisingly. And I picked up one called, it's called The Earthquake That America Forgot. And it was by Dr. David Stewart and Dr. Ray Knox, a regional publication. And it was just this great, it was a great browsing kind of book. It had all these little, you know, short story, not, you know, short little vignettes about what happened during the earthquake, what the pioneers went through to survive this. I mean, just some amazing stuff. I remember thinking at the time, I was like, why hasn't somebody set a story, you know, Western, against this backdrop? Because, I mean, not only do you have potential for sort of an apocalypse now kind of journey into darkness, you know, and journey into the heart of darkness, but you've got this earthquake going on, you know, it's just, and it was a fascinating period of time, too. I mean, it affected so many historical figures, too. There was a Shawnee leader by the name of Tecumseh at the time who actually predicted the earthquake, which is another kind of bizarre thing. And he was trying to unite all of the Eastern Indian tribes. And Tecumseh actually is in my story, too. Robert, my main character, was kidnapped as a young man, much like Davy Crockett was, and raised for a short time by the Shawnee and befriended him. But Tecumseh actually is a real figure, and he predicted the earthquake was going to happen, and he was trying to join the Eastern tribes into a confederacy, basically, and you know, unite and push the white man off the continent. And their call to arms was going to be when this big earthquake happened. His brother kind of messed things up for him before that happened, but yeah, he predicted months before the thing even happened that it was going to happen. So, yeah, there's a lot of fascinating stories about this, and really my idea came from just reading and doing my research about the earthquake and just wondering why, you know, no one had ever done this before.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of these kinds. That's why when I was browsing through the previews listings and I saw this one, I thought, oh, that sounds pretty cool. Let me search around, you know, because I, at the time, hadn't seen, you know, I just saw the little blurb and previews, which is some text, you know. You know, it's like, oh, let me do a quick search. So, you know, the wonders of Google, you know, I found blackpowdercomic.com, you know, DwayneHarris.com, all these places that have the stuff. And then you actually, up on the blackpowdercomic.com, you've got some nice stuff. You got the characters, you got some fact versus fiction, and you got the 9 pages of the comic preview. And once I read through the 9 pages, I'm like, okay, this is cool. This is going on my pull list to get this when it comes out. And that's when I contacted you to talk to you so that we could, you know, let some more people know about it. Now, one of the things I wanted to talk about now is just your process on the art, because you're doing the writing and the art on this. Now, your art is a painted style. Why don't you talk a little bit about your process for creating the book?
Well, I work in a couple different styles. I did a miniseries before for Boom Comics, and it was a Warhammer miniseries, and it was called Warhammer Crown Destruction. And I did that was in a line art style. So when I originally did my preview pages to kind of start shopping Black Powder around, I did it in that line art style, and showed it around, had some interest in stuff, and I talked to Frank at WonderCon in San Francisco, and he just fell in love with it, and we just had a great conversation, and you know, just really kind of hit off. But I was looking at a lot of this stuff, and I've always been a big fan of painted comic book work. You know, I love Richard Corbin's, you know, painted work. I love, you know, I mean, it just, you know, goes on. I'm really digging a lot of stuff that's going on over at Radical right now too. And I was talking to those guys and checking out their books, and I just got to thinking, you know, I made originally, sort of before I started doing the comics, I was more known for book covers and magazine illustrations. I did some trading card art and stuff like that, and it was all, you know, it was all done in a painted sort of style. It's really what I'm more comfortable with. So I thought, well, why not just, you know, why not try this and see? It's definitely more time consuming than line art, but so I you know, I took some time and I redid my early pages and painted it. I work in Photoshop with a Wacom tablet, and I do sort of, I try to emulate basically the same way that I used to paint by hand. I have a BFA in painting, and the look that I'm you know, that I do now in my digital work is much like how I used to paint. It's sort of like I'm trying to do sort of a wet, almost watercolory oil sort of style. And so I did those pages like that, sent them to Frank, and he loved them, and I was like, well, great, well, let's do it like this. And started painting them, and realized it was going to take absolutely forever. So I told Frank, you know, I don't know if this is a good idea, maybe we should revert back to the line art. And he was in love with the painting, so we stuck with it. And it's just been turning out really great. It's been looking really good. But yes, as far as my process, I'm a Photoshop painter. A lot of people like, you know, Painter. Corel, I guess Corel doesn't own it now, but Painter. And I love that. I love that program. Anymore though, I've just really learned, you know, kind of do my own thing in Photoshop. And so I work there. A lot of times I'll start off with, I'll do thumbnails on paper, and get a quick, you know, sketches, and then I'll scan that in and start with that, and then just start painting. I use photographs some. For this one in particular, I actually went on location to. I didn't mention this, but the pirates in my story, they actually work out of a cave called Cave In Rock, or they operate out of a cave called Cave In Rock, and that's historically true. It is a cave alongside the Ohio Bend, the river there, and it's been featured in a few movies, actually. There's been Davy Crockett and the River Pirates back from the 50s was filmed there. How the West Was Won, a segment of that was filmed there as well. But these pirates, they lived in this cave, and they had a clear view of upriver from this. So they would sit and wait for you know, people in flatboats traveling by to come, and then they had signs up saying that this was it was called Samuel Mason's Vault of Liquor and Entertainment, and you know, these people would come there expecting this vault of liquor entertainment, and we would turn into a vault and for them, but not what they're expecting. But they would basically, you know, they would jump them and take all their belongings and then float their riverboat on down to New Orleans, sell all their stuff, and then come back up to the cave and do it over again. So kind of an interesting little thing. Most people think of pirates, you know, they think of Pirates of the Caribbean and so forth. But obviously these guys were, you know, they were muddier and bloodier than the Pirates of the Caribbean. But I went to visit the cave where all this happened, and I shot a lot of reference photos there. I even got somebody to take me out on a boat so I could get some photos of the cave from the river, because I needed that perspective as well. So worked from that quite a bit, and but yeah, in essence, I work in Photoshop. I'm a digital artist. Kind of a long answer to a short question there, but
yeah, no, I'm gonna maybe it's good because I like hearing that. You know, I'm gonna maybe butcher some of the artistic terms here since I'm no artist, but I like looking at it. It's, you know, you kind of have the style. I don't know what you call it, but it's kind of a softer style, right? It's not that crisp photorealistic style that you'd see from like an Alex Ross or something. You know, it's like when I'm looking at the preview pages here, you know, the way that, you know, you're capturing kind of like the, you know, the environment and, you know, some of the trees and, you know, some of the just nice kind of soft edges to things, and it just has a feel to it, especially coupled with the coloring. You know, it kind of feels like 1800s, you know, it's like, oh, it's kind of cool. I like the way that you did that. Is that just your general style, or did you come at this with any kind of a feeling for the mood and how you wanted to set that?
I was really trying to, what I'm really trying to do is emulate the Brandywine school, and that's N.C. Wyeth. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he's some people would say the king of American illustration, really. He, a lot of times when you think of like the classics, like the original editions of Last of the Mohicans, of, Treasure Island, you know, Robert Louis Stevenson, some of the early Tarzan and stuff, he did the covers for that. And he had sort of this big, heroic kind of, yeah, loose kind of gutsy style that I'm definitely trying to do here too. That was purposeful. It's a little different. Like, it's somewhat like what I used to do in actual oils, but yes, I did sort of try to tailor my style to fit the subject a little bit and to kind of evoke that old fashioned, you know, sort of illustration feel, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I mean, you use a lot of browns and, you know, kind of sepia tone kind of stuff there, where it looks kind of like the photographs. I mean, there's some color in there; it's not mm-hmm. totally, you know, brown and white, but it's got that kind of a color palette. You know, very earthy.
Yep, I'm trying to go
at least the preview pages.
Exactly. Yeah, trying to go with sort of muted colors, for that Western kind of feel to it. That sepia. Sort of old, like you said, old Western photograph kind of look. I think my colors have gotten a little brighter as I've moved along in the series, but overall there is that definitely that look, and that is intentional. So glad you like it.
So when you're doing this, now you're using the digital art, and you're doing kind of like the painting, you know, all digitally in Photoshop here. You've done the physical oil painting before too, right? As you were learning, how do you compare the two? You know, just kind of process wise, you know, taking your mouse or whatever you use on your Wacom tablet versus holding that brush in your hand and going at a canvas or, you know, or board.
Yeah. Well, when I first started doing this, digital art was still pretty new thing, and I've actually been using Photoshop since, oh gosh, early on, since like early 90s. So I remember back then trying to paint, you know, with an actual mouse. And to me, that process was always kind of like trying to draw with a bar of soap. You know, it's just really hard to do, and it's not intuitive at all. With the tablet now, and Wacom makes the best one, I'm not sure how you pronounce it. I hear different ones all the time. But with the Wacom tablet, it actually is pressure sensitive, and you have a pen that you draw and paint with. And so the harder you press, the thicker your line is. And so it really, to me, once you get past, of course, the fact that you're not actually drawing on the screen, that you're not actually looking, you know, that removal of your hand from the screen, once you get past that, to me, it really feels about the same, to be honest. And you know, there's not all the oils and the mess to clean up afterwards either. So I love it.
Yeah, I guess you don't have to go to the art store and buy all those supplies either once you have the computer and all that kind of setup, right?
Exactly.
No scanning it in, no, none of that.
None of that stuff, and you're not breathing mineral spirits all day, you know? So, yeah, I love it, and I've been doing it for so long now. It just really feels about the same to me. So, and it's definitely quicker. I think it's, you know, I was talking to an illustrator friend of mine who made the switch some time ago, and you know, he was one of the, well, I won't say one of the last holdouts. Of course, there's still plenty of people out there who work, you know, traditionally, and thank goodness there are. But he was a holdout for sure. But what really got him finally was just the time constraints. You know, he says, he can work so much faster, basically, and it's a deadline oriented business. You know, it really is. So that's, you know, that's definitely a consideration. And I think if you've already developed your style and everything beforehand, I mean, it's just a matter of translating that to a different medium.
So you bring up an interesting point then. So how long does it take you to do a page?
Black Powder takes me, I can do a page of line art a day. Black Powder is not quite 2 days, but close enough that it might as well be, probably, I guess. I'd say a day and a half, if it's going really well, to 2 days. So, you know, it would be, I suppose if I was trying to put a monthly book, it would be a bi-monthly sort of thing, probably.
So that's a considerable time investment, right? You know, because each issue, well, it's solicited as 56 pages, and I'm always kind of unsure with comics because they count total pages in the issue in the solicits, not story pages. How many story pages are in each of the three issues?
44.
It's a double comic book.
It's a double issue, yeah.
Yeah.
We just decided to do that for a number of different reasons. But I wrote the thing as a 6-issue miniseries, and so it's follows that format. We broke it into chapters instead of issues instead. So each one is 22 pages. So this one is 44 pages of story, and then there's going to be some extras, you know, some essays, maybe some pinups. We're still kind of putting those details together, but we'll see. 56 pages total.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's you'll see it there in the previews catalog from Asylum Press, so it'll be near the front of the back section. It comes right around Avatar, and you know, you will see
Arcana,
you know, all the A's. It'll be bunched in there in the front part of the catalog. It'll be $7.95 suggested retail price, but you know, keep in account that is a double size issue, and it's going to be a 3-issue series with 6 issues of content that you're used to reading as a normal comic book. So, thank you very much for joining me, Dwayne. And
I am
absolutely looking forward to seeing this book come out. If you check the show notes for this episode, I'll have a link to where you can go and view those 9 preview pages and see some of the other stuff that Dwayne's got on the website, character profiles and some stuff. Also, I'll also put a link to the Wikipedia page on the New Madrid earthquake. just as a extra fun little thing if somebody wants to read up on that.
Oh, that's a great idea. Excellent.
Thanks a lot, and thanks for joining me.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.